May it please the court, my name is Natalie Hollaby, registration number 39138, and I represent the petitioner Jose Montalvo Lopez. The issue presented in this case is whether Rule 16 of the Colorado Rules of Criminal Procedure requires the prosecution to disclose a witness statement that is made to another governmental authority but is within the prosecution's possession. I will first discuss the Court of Appeals opinion, then the applicable parts of Rule 16, and then I'll move on to their application in this case.
Why don't you just wait a second?
Yeah.
While you're waiting, maybe the chief can give you a couple of seconds. You might pull up the mic a little, the podium a little bit so we can hear you better. Somebody answered.
Okay, go ahead.
The Court of Appeals committed error in this case in relying on subsection 1C1 of Rule 16 to reach its conclusion here. Citing section 1C1, the Court of Appeals held that any discovery violation was harmless because the defendant failed to request his co-defendant's statement. Subsection 1C1 applies to material held by other governmental personnel that is not in the prosecution's possession. Under this subsection, the prosecution does not have the duty to automatically disclose information. And because the prosecution's obligation is not automatic, and because the Court of Appeals found that defense counsel did not request the statement, as we would be required under this part of the rule, the Court of Appeals found that any discovery violation was harmless. However, subsection 1C1 does not apply in this case. Court of Appeals opinion ignores the fact that the statement was in the prosecution's possession, and furthermore, that the statement was taken by an investigator who participated in the investigation of this case and reported to the prosecution on this case. The prosecutor conceded that he sent the investigator to meet with the co-defendant and that the co-defendant provided information about his drug supplier so that the prosecutor would make a favorable recommendation at sentencing. Because of these facts, this case falls squarely under either subsections 1A1 or 1A3 of Rule 16.
Well, let me understand this. So somehow the prosecutor realized this, that it was a violation, should have been turned over, and decided not to use the information in the trial. And if I understand, at least the contention that it was the defense that opened up the issue, is that correct?
Well, the prosecutor argued that the defendant somehow opened the door to this statement, although he conceded and admitted that the defense did not have the statement himself. And the defense's the alleged opening of the door happened during the cross-examination of the arresting officer, who was a different officer who took the statement in this case. The statement that's at issue here. And defense counsel asked, he, referring to the co-defendant, actually provided information about his supplier. And then the arresting officer, says, well, I don't really know. I don't know in what detail, and I don't know because he wasn't the one who took that statement. So all the defense counsel knows is that the co-defendant had provided information about his supplier. But defense counsel doesn't know the full contents of the statement. It's clear he doesn't know that the co-defendant also implicates Mr. Montalvo Lopez in that statement.
Well, the question seems to imply that the statement is about the co-defendant's supplier, correct? I mean, that's the question.
Right.
And so at that point, The officer basically says there was a statement made, I don't know the detail, but it seems to me that the question has sort of left the impression that the officer doesn't know the detail of the statement concerning the co-defendant's supplier. Well, as it turns out, the statement is actually a little different than that. It's about the defendant's supplier. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And so I guess what I'm left with from your argument is not understanding why at that point in time, it seems that, aside from whether it's opening the door, that certainly the defense has created a situation where the entirety of the statement seems to be important to clear up a misimpression that the defense has left. Now, that's sort of an impression statement, but I guess I'd like you to answer that in terms of what legal principles would seem to apply to that. Obviously, what I'm saying is, it certainly sounds like opening the door to me.
Well, we have to keep in mind that the defendant or the defense counsel didn't know what he was opening the door to.
Well, which that makes it a stupid question, maybe. Forgive my defense attorney is here. Forgive me. That's a statement that, you know, violates the principles of cross-examination, I suppose, a question that does. But nonetheless, is there some notion in the doctrine of opening the door that if you don't know what you're opening the door to, then it doesn't happen?
Opening the door is just intended so that one party cannot really gain an advantage over another party by selectively introducing evidence into trial that would otherwise not be admissible or would not otherwise come in. You can't say that defense counsel was really creating an advantage for himself here, because the evidence that ended up coming in was what completely undermined his entire defense. So I think that a lot is made of this vague and ambiguous statement that defense counsel actually asks the arresting officer, but I'm not sure that it's even clear that he's opening the door, but what is clear is that he doesn't know the contents of the statement, and he doesn't know it precisely because the prosecutor has kept it from him.
Can I stop you right there? Just want to iron out that point. Is there any debate then about what this discussion was between the prosecutor and the defense counsel before trial? Or are you saying that it is clear and not debatable that the prosecutor didn't turn over this report, didn't turn over the statement, and didn't tell the defense counsel the contents of the statement?
Well, if we look at the record, the court asks defense counsel, you know, are you saying that you didn't get a copy of this statement? And defense counsel says that's correct. And then the court turns to the prosecutor and says, is that true? And the prosecutor said, that's true. So he there is admitting that he did not turn over a copy of the statement. He says, there was an extensive discussion with defense counsel and defense counsel for the co-defendant and I about that statement. I have no intention of bringing it up and had discussed with defense counsel that we would not bring it up. So we don't know the entirety of that conversation. We know that at least part of the conversation was about how this statement was not going to be introduced at trial, it was not going to be an issue, it wasn't going to be raised. We also know from defense counsel's later statement to the court, just a couple moments later, where he says, I was aware that there was a meeting and information was provided, but not provided with any of the actual details of that information. So defense counsel is explaining that while he maybe knew that the co-defendant had spoken with this investigator, he didn't know what the co-defendant had told him in that investigation.
And it is that line in the testimony from which you get the position that defense counsel didn't know.
Right. Well, and also, I mean, he's saying here, he's very clear that he doesn't know what happened in that or what the contents of that statement are, but also the fact that, you know, when the prosecutor asks the co-defendant this question that leads to this entire conversation, he says, you provided information to the DEA about the people who gave the drugs to you and your nephew. And it's at that moment that defense counsel objects and said that there's no foundation laid for the statement in discovery, saying, I don't know this. I don't know that the drugs were given to my client, to the defendant. And again, in closing argument, the defense counsel mentions again twice that this is the first time he's hearing anything about the co-defendant implicating the defendant in this case, you know, saying this is the first time he's coming in here. I'll read it. Not a shred of evidence regarding who put the drugs in the car, who the drugs were delivered to, except the co-defendant coming in for the first time and saying these were delivered to my nephew. And he says that more than once in closing argument, again supporting the idea that he did not know the critical, the substance of this co-defendant's statement.
Now, is it your position that the prosecution had the obligation to turn over the statement, or is it your position that the defense was under no obligation to request a copy after supposedly they had this discussion? I'm not clear exactly what you're saying.
Right. Well, because this is a statement that was in the prosecutor's possession, for one thing, and for another thing, it was also in the possession of an investigating officer who worked with the prosecution on this case, the obligation of the prosecutor was mandatory and automatic. It didn't necessitate a request from defense counsel in order to get disclosure here. Its disclosure was required regardless of whether or not there was a request, because the rule, parts 1A1 and 1A3, are both self-executing.
So do we know in this case that whether the defense did get other discovery? Do we know? Is this a case where the defendant just didn't bother to go check the file?
No, I mean, we know that there is other discovery here. You know, we don't have any other surprises coming up at trial. This is really the only one. At least from my understanding of the policies in this case, and I don't know about all jurisdictions, but I know that, you know, the prosecutor will put all the information together and then defense counsel will go get it. And so it's clear here that this was somehow excluded from the rest of discovery.
Well, is that point in dispute at all? That's what I was trying to get at. Do we know whether?
Well, I mean, I guess the record is pretty, the record doesn't say, you know, we gave him everything else except for this. It's not that clear. But we do have the prosecutor admitting that this statement was taken shortly after the arrest, so that we know that this could have been disclosed with initial discovery. And the prosecutor also states, this is not new information, this is information that was known back then. He says that in closing argument in rebuttal. Again, you know, suggesting that this is something that should have been disclosed from the very beginning so that the defense counsel could make an informed decision as to what defense to present to the jury.
How do we even know that the statement was actually in the hands of the prosecution as opposed to just the DEA?
Well, the prosecutor says...
I mean, the prosecutor may have seen it, but did he have it to give to the defendant? And the record is very, very sketchy about the relationship between the DEA and the prosecutor here. I understand that this case arose as a result of a traffic stop, and therefore it was a state matter, proceeded that way. Co-defendant arose as a result of a DEA investigation. Nonetheless, it went state, but they weren't tried together. Right.
They weren't tried together.
And there was no
pled guilty prior to this trial.
There was not necessarily a joint investigation or a state task force which included DEA agents. We just don't have any idea.
We do know this. The prosecutor repeatedly referred to the Grand Junction Task Force or the Drug Task Force or the DEA Task Force, and that's at pages 11, 134.
We don't know anything other than, we just don't know, do we?
Well, we know that there is some sort of joint cooperation here. We know there's a task force, and we know the prosecutor sent this investigator to the co-defendant with the express purpose of getting a statement for him in order to give him some leniency at sentencing. We know that much. I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Well, I have one more question.
Okay.
I thought that the DEA agents got that statement on their own, that that wasn't at the direction of the prosecution.
The prosecutor says, you know, I sent somebody from the drug task force to come interview you, right? He's asking the co-defendant, and the co-defendant says, yes.
But is that the statement that we're talking about, even?
Well, he says here, you know, that...
We don't know that from this record, do we?
I guess we don't know the full functioning of this task force, but we know that the prosecutor worked with the investigator here with respect to the co-defendant, which was arising out of the same case. I see that I am out of time.
Chief, can I ask you more questions?
Sure.
Now, maybe
we took up some of your time earlier, so fine.
I want to focus on what Justice Rice was asking you. My understanding, and this, correct me if this is wrong, co-defendant entered a state plea, right?
Yes.
So he was prosecuted in state court?
Yes.
The person that took the statement was a joint officer of the Mesa County law enforcement, as well as commissioned by the DEA, right? Which is very common, isn't it?
That's what the prosecutor said, yes.
So this was always a state prosecution, right?
Right. It was. So I would just ask this court to reverse the opinion of the Court of Appeals, and the alternative, if the court feels that the record is too incomplete, to, with respect to this discovery violation, maybe a remand is in order to determine some of the factual issues, with directions, of course, as to the prosecutor's obligations.
May it please the court and counsel, my name is Paul Kaler. I'm assistant attorney general of the Department of Law's Appellate Division. I really like the contentious part of my job, but I don't feel like I'm going to be fighting against the issue on which cert was granted today, because that was our position in the Court of Appeals, that there's at least three portions of Rule 16 under which would make this discoverable. Our argument here, as it was below, is that the prosecution provided notice that this report existed. If the defendant wanted a copy under Rule 16, he was required to request a copy. And if the prosecution was being recalcitrant in its discovery obligations, defense counsel then had an obligation to take care, to employ the conflict or the dispute resolution provisions of the Rule 16.
Well, the defense attorney doesn't have to make a request if there's an automatic duty to turn over the statement. Isn't that right?
No. So
the question really boils down to something a little bit more subtle than the way you're proposing it, which is there an automatic duty to turn over the statement, or is there a requirement under a different section of the rule for the defense to make a request?
Our argument under the rules, Your Honor, is that the defense was notified of the statement's existence. I don't know why. The record is very thin, and that's the only caution I have for the court. I've noticed a couple of questions where people were making assumptions about what the record said. The record here is pretty limited. It's right around, it's all in volume 6, right around pages 100 and pages 140. It's very sketchy record. It's clear from the record, though, Your Honor, that the defense was aware of this statement because the defense attempted to use it for tactics.
So it's almost semantic. The defense was aware of the statement. The statement had been discussed with the defense. But is all this case about whether or not the defense had to go ahead and take the extra step of saying, well, give it to me, or whether the prosecutor had to say, here it is?
Yes.
If that is the difference in this, in your positions, please focus on that.
Okay. The very beginning of CRIMP 16-1A-1 says the prosecuting attorney shall make available, and our argument is that since the defendant was aware of it, it was made available to him. I don't think the record states that the defense requested a photocopy of the complete statement and was denied it by the prosecution. It really says that statement was not given to the defendant. There were extensive discussions.
Mr. Keller, can I ask a question? I just had this recollection, maybe this is wrong.
Okay.
That there was a formal Rule 16 standard motion filed in this case.
Right, yeah, I quoted it verbatim in our...
So the question would be, why wasn't that under the rules at that time? You saying there wasn't discovery? Sort of the questions the chief was asking.
I think it was made available. The prosecution discussed the existence of this interview with the defendant, and the defense counsel was apparently aware of at least some of the particulars of this statement.
So in other words, because he knew that there was the existence of a statement, which I'm sure shouldn't have come as any surprise to him, since the co-defendant was cooperating and pled guilty. Your position is that's sufficient under the rule, that that makes it available, as opposed to an open book policy where you just give everything that you have about the case?
Yes, Your Honor, and I realize most prosecuting offices have open file policies of the things, and then the defense can request copies or whatever. In my office, for example, we oftentimes our white collar prosecutions have voluminous discovery available. We do not run a copy of everything in our files. Defense counsel comes in, looks at it, and says, "I would like a copy of these documents."
Well, is that what happened here?
That's what I'm saying.
We don't know what happened. Do we even know that the copy of the statement was in the prosecutor's file?
We don't know that either, Your Honor. It's a very thin record, and that's why I.
But Mr. Kaler, yes, the record is thin, but what we do know is that the prosecutor agreed not to use the statement and told the defendant of the statement, but not the detail. Is that correct?
I would except for the last part. I think the defense knew of the statement. The prosecutor said he would not employ it. It's not clear from the record that they had not discussed in detail the contents of the uncle's statement.
Okay. It's clear that he wasn't provided with the statement, and that he did make the statement, the defense attorney, that he didn't know the detail. Isn't that right?
I would ask you to check the limited record. I'm not sure the record.
Maybe not.
The appellate record says it that.
All right. Well, I think where I'm going is that seems to me, and I realize there's no record on this, it's not clear, but it seems to strongly imply that the prosecutor, acknowledged a discovery violation and offered a remedy for it. In other words, said, and maybe that's too technical, but basically said, seems to suggest that the prosecutor thought there was something wrong and therefore agreed not to use the statement.
Maybe so. And I think one thing, I'm hypothesizing. So the defendant was mulling a lot of cocaine through Colorado, I-70, started in L.A., he was going to Chicago, DEA was involved. I would hope the DEA was trying to track down their source in L.A. and their eventual destination. I could see why the DEA would want
This is interesting, but the briefs are replete with this kind of argument, and it's not helpful. So what do we actually know? Nothing. Don't tell me anything more than what we actually know.
We know that there was a report. We know that
that was created by a DEA agent at the behest of the prosecutor. Maybe we know that. Maybe we don't.
I would say maybe on that.
All right, go ahead.
There were extensive discussions about this report.
Where was the report? In the file of the DEA agent or in the file of the prosecutor? We don't know that.
That's unclear, Your Honor. That's okay. Why we said...
Okay, then the next thing that happened is that there was a conversation.
There was a conversation. The DEA said he was not planning on introducing the statement. And I don't think any sort of suggestion that they thought there was any sort of discovery.
And that's it. That's what we know.
Right.
That's the entirety of the record with respect to this document.
I believe so, Your Honor. I quoted and cited every kernel about it I could in our answer brief. So it's thin, and I can see, and it is. It made me wonder why.
I think it's emaciated.
Even that. But the question is, did the prosecution meet its discovery requirements? Does the language talking of Rule 16 says shall provide duplicates upon request? Mr. Things, does that mean that the defense actually has to make a request for duplicates, or does the prosecution only have to open its file but copy its file and hand it
Wait a minute. You keep moving off into copying, but I don't see that as being what's at issue here. What seems to be at issue is, has the discovery been made available by telling defense counsel that you've got something? Now, you're saying you don't have to have an open file policy. You don't have to tell him he can inspect the file. You don't have to provide him a copy. You just have to tell him you've got it, and that makes it available under the rule, and then he has to make a specific request?
I think Again, I think we're hypothesizing on our emaciated record.
Okay. Maybe I'm mischaracterizing your argument. I thought what you were saying satisfied the rule.
The prosecution has to provide notice that this information exists. Normally, DAs give out more than they, I think, that, than they need to under the explicit direct language of CRIM P16. In this particular case, where for some reason, it may have just been an omission that somebody else had the report on their desk, and when the defense attorney came by, it wasn't there to be photocopied. That could have been the reason. And anyway, the prosecutor said, I will not introduce this information. And the prosecution did not introduce this information. Defense counsel raised the issue as cross-examination of the arresting officer. And then the uncle, who was testifying as a hostile prosecution witness, he testified that neither of them, that he did not know where the cocaine came from. And that's how it was actually
May I ask you a follow-up on that, just in terms of the relationship between the rule, who makes a violation at what point in time in this opening the door argument? If the rule were violated by not making available this document, then would it make any difference if defense counsel opened the door or whatever we call it? Would it still be a violation?
No. If defense counsel was completely unaware of the fact that the uncle had given a statement to the DEA, and if the prosecution had hid that fact, that would be a violation, and that would be.
Whether the defense counsel opened the door or not, don't we have to decide whether this document was made available? And so,
yeah.
Does initially we have to sort of accept that? What I think you're arguing is that by telling him that such a document existed, the prosecutor satisfied his obligations under 16-1A1 to make available. Is that right?
Right. Letting him know. And then if there is a problem, the rules set forth procedures for resolving that. And it says the trial court will resolve these matters promptly. And when there's a problem, if the defense counsel wanted more, he had to say, trial court, I'm aware of this. The prosecution has made me aware of this document and will not give me a copy of it or will not let me read it. And then the trial court can come down on the prosecution and say, prosecution, make this. If the defense is aware, like it was here, and does not make a complaint to the trial court, our argument is that the issue is waived. Defense counsel was aware of it, tried to use it tactically. And the prosecution didn't even try getting the report then. It was only when the uncle tried committing perjury while trying to help out his nephew that the prosecution got into the particulars of that. So this isn't really, the prosecution wasn't using this to hammer the defendant. The prosecution, in a way, was forced to by the uncle's testimony and by defense counsel's initial addressing of the issue. So certainly, I don't know, brief or trial prosecutors who hide documents and mislead defense attorneys and things like that, but here, the defense was aware that this interview had taken place. It was probably aware that it had been reduced to writing in some form. If it wanted more details, it was incumbent upon the defense to use the dispute resolution procedures set forth in CRIM P16. That's why the rule is such a valuable tool. It sets everything out A, B, C, D, and E. And it's because the defendant did not do that, the issue is waived. Even if the prosecutor was being mean in some way, that defense counsel was aware at the time. And for us now, for me to be up here hypothesizing about why things happen, that's part of the reason why, to prevent this type of hypothesizing is a reason why CRIM P16 sets forward these procedures down below, so that the trial court can make an informed decision.
If I can just pick up on one of the last things you said, would it be fair then to say your understanding of this questioning by the defense counsel, the opening the door problem, goes to whether the prosecutor deceived him or was unfair in saying, you know, telling him that he wouldn't use it and then using it, but it doesn't go to the question whether it was made available under Rule 16.
I don't think opening the door really has any idea because the statement was not introduced at all, really. It was referred to in cross-examination prior to a consistent statement. I don't think opening the door really advances the question. When I wrote in our brief was it just this cross-examination of the arresting officer with this statement, which I think the prosecution objected to on hearsay grounds, it merely showed that the defense was aware of the existence of this report and was aware of at least some of the particulars contained in this report. That's all we're using that particular statement for here, to show that there was, it was disclosed, the existence was disclosed, and that the defense was aware of at least something that was contained in there, and that the defense that wanted more details should have complained to the trial court that it wanted more details. Because I think under the rules, under the three subsections of the rules we talked about, I think it is discoverable for one or another reason, depending on the various factual predicates involved. But again, I say in our brief below, I say it's potentially discoverable under these three sections, and I said potentially because we don't really know the factual, or we don't really know all the factual predicates involved. That's all I have. If the court has any other questions I could try and address. Thank you very much, Your Honors.
On behalf of the court, I want to thank both counsel for your argument. The case will stand. The court will be in recess.